Hello, and welcome to the new Art of the Cut podcast, brought to you in partnership with Frame.io. My name is Steve Hallfish. I'm a feature film and documentary editor. For more than 7 years, over 300 interviews, I've been speaking to my colleagues in film, TV, and docs about the art and craft of editing. Today, we're speaking with Joshua L. Pearson about cutting the Questlove documentary Summer of Soul about the so-called Harlem Woodstock. Joshua has been nominated for 3 Emmys for his sound work on the documentary Under African Skies and for his sound work and picture editing on the nonfiction program What Happened, Miss Simone. He was also nominated for an Ace Eddie for Best Edited Documentary for Keith Richards' Under the Influence. He also edited the Ron Howard documentary Made in America and has also cut scripted narrative like Tears of a King and Shrek the Musical. That's quite the range. If you're interested in reading this interview with visual support and clips and trailers, head on over to blog.frame.io, where there's a ton of great expert content for film professionals of all types. The choice of starting any documentary is critical, and I was really interested in the opening sound and the opening images that you chose to start this, which are kind of behind-the-scenes audio. Yeah. And then a question from the interviewer, which is pretty rare, that doesn't even get answered right then. Talk to me about why the documentary was started like that.
Well, the beginning of the film went through a bunch of different changes. I mean, we did know that we wanted to start with the Stevie Wonder drum solo. And early on, I thought it might be cool to try to build some mystery around what was going on. We get dropped into the middle of this giant crowd of people. You don't know where you are. And all you're hearing is the murmur of the crowd. And then I wanted there to be a drone, because I love drones. But I thought I also wanted it to be natural. And there's no music in the film that doesn't come from the concert itself.
Oh, interesting.
There's no score. I actually was like, oh, how about a propeller airplane drone, like on a summer day?
Oh, yeah.
You know, you're in the park and you hear that drone of the airplane flying overhead. So I added that. And Questlove and the producer, Joseph Patel, really loved that. But then down the line, a couple months later, it just wasn't exciting enough. And I believe it was actually Joseph Patel's idea with working with Questlove to actually try to toss in some of the Nat sound from the announcer, you know, all those classic things you hear at a concert, like, we've got your wallet over here, your mother's waiting for you. And there were all these great announcements from the stage. And and then adding in a couple little tape glitches to make it seem like you're watching a memory. So that was a very interesting little thing that working on this film made me realize originally everybody wanted it to be immersive, like Woodstock is immersive. The problem is there's a huge difference between the way Woodstock was shot and the way this Harlem Cultural Festival was shot, which is that Woodstock had 15 camera people wandering around the crowd with 8mm cameras, capturing all the stuff that was going on, in addition to the cameras that were on the stage, on the artists performing. Whereas this film, they didn't have that. As you can hear in the film, Hal Tulchin, the guy who shot it, was very low budget. It was almost on spec. And so all he had were the 5 cameras pointed at the stage. So there's nothing really that immersive in a Woodstock-y kind of way about it. So it made me realize, instead of trying to lean into that too hard, I realized, oh, well, this is also a film about an artifact. That's a big part of this film, of course, is that you're looking at this artifact that's been buried in some guy's basement for 50 years. Other directors did try to make this film in the last 15 years or so. It has surfaced here and there. There's little clips on YouTube. But in treating it more like a combination of an artifact and trying to make it feel immersive. So that's why in the beginning you get a little bit of the tape glitches. The tape machines are trying to get going, but somehow it also feels immersive, which is kind of cool. And then the decision to start it with Musa Jackson is the interview subject, who was a little boy at the time. That came pretty late in the game, where we really wanted to emphasize the framing of this film, the presentation of this film, again, as an artifact. And so I realized it was kind of the perfect way to do that. Because by then, we already had him ending the film. So he also ends the film, and he goes on that great riff with Questlove about, now, thank you. Now I know I'm not crazy. Because when we showed these people the footage, it truly was the first time they'd seen this stuff in 50 years. It really was very emotional for a lot of people, artists and attendees alike.
Well, that's another one of the things that you can tell that the interviewees are watching footage. And really that opening sets up, oh, by the way, these people are looking kind of at themselves.
Right.
You know, an announcer doesn't come on and say, oh, and now they're looking at themselves. You don't want to do that.
Yeah, no.
So that opening thing set that up too.
Yeah, and I'm glad it comes across because we were thinking about different ways of representing people watching themselves. We thought about, oh, do we get a projector and project behind them what they're looking at? Mm. And that all just got a little too complicated, and other films do that. There's another music doc where you see people sitting in front of this giant projection screen, and there's a camera behind them and also a camera on them. But in this case, we just went with simple, and you can kind of see the television light on their face.
Mm-hmm.
And so you get it. But, oh, they're looking at the monitor. And in that case, you actually hear Questlove's voice. Again, as you mentioned, we chose to use Questlove's voice also to establish Questlove at the top of the film. He did not want to be a character in the film. He did not really want to be in any way part of the body of the film, but he was into this idea of you just hear his voice a couple of times. Actually, I think you only hear it at the very beginning and the very end.
Mm.
So you hear him say, look, all right, let's bring in a monitor.
Yeah. I really liked you were talking about trying to make it immersive, or the decision that you couldn't make it immersive, but there's a great period early on where it's just the crowd noise without music.
Yeah.
Like you're just listening to
yeah.
And not cheering.
Right. Again, that was actually the one big attempt to make it feel immersive. If you're going to do that, yeah, there's not music playing. It just seemed like the right spot for it. Again, it's the same guy, Musa Jackson. He just did this great little riff about what it was like there that day, and the smells and the sights and the food. And so he goes on this great little riff, and I just felt like that was the perfect opportunity to put on display the best crowd shots. It's not like Woodstock. There's no handheld camera in the crowd, unfortunately. It's only these cameras from the stage every now and then are pointing out into the crowd, and they've got powerful zoom lenses, so they're able to get in close on people's faces. And then, of course, there are these great photographs that were taken. All these great photographs, that was the closest we could get to immersive footage. Photographer was in and among the crowd, and just seemed like the right moment. And yeah, it's just murmuring crowd noise. And then, because it's Musa telling the story about the crowd, I thought, oh, well, that's a perfect way to segue into the Fifth Dimension performance, which is the great story where he's got a crush on Marilyn McCoo. And so we ramp up the sound of the band starting to play, and it just makes for a nice moment.
Yeah, I love that. I felt like there was some handheld stuff. Was there film footage from other crews?
We had an archivist working, of course, on the team, a woman named Elizabeth McGlynn. I've worked with her on a few different things, and she goes very, very deep looking for archival footage. And shockingly, or not surprisingly, the only other coverage that we found of the concert is midway through the film is the Apollo landing moment.
Mm.
It was the only other news coverage of the concert was literally that moment where first the astronauts land on the moon, Walter Cronkite wipes a tear from his eye, and 30 seconds later, he comes back and they actually did a throw. He does a throw to the reporter in the field, standing there in the middle of the crowd. And that's the guy who then asks the people, what do you think of the moon landing? And they all say, well, it's cool, but it doesn't do anything to help us. But weirdly, that was the only other footage we ever found at this concert. When they put out a call to try to find people who'd been there, the attendees, of course, were asking, like, if anyone has any footage or had an 8mm camera with them, but nobody came up.
Wow.
We couldn't find anybody who had footage.
Because in that opening Stevie Wonder performance, there are edits that I felt were live edits. Like, you could tell it was probably a guy pushing a button on a truck. But then there were some others that felt more cinematic. I felt like the editor's hand was there going, no, we're not going to go with the line cut. I'm going to put something in there.
Well, I did have to do a little bit of cheating here and there because we actually had no choice but to go with the line cut, because I'm assuming that because of the low budget that Hal Tulchin had,
no ISOs.
There were no ISOs. We found two ISOs. That was the first day, opening day. and it was of the fifth, it was a side angle camera of the fifth dimension performing, and it was kind of on them the whole time, but they were also on the crowd a lot as well. That was the only ISO we found. So when there are performers performing, I would cheat shots from other performances by that artist. So the artist will perform six or seven songs. We're only doing one in the film. So that gives me a pool of footage that I could potentially pull from and sync it up and cheat it in. I did that for the opening of the Gladys Knight and the Pips, because all we had to work with was the line cut. And when they start the song that they do in the film, Heard It Through the Grapevine, obviously they were having a problem because there's only one long wide shot of the whole band and it's wobbling up and down. It's just a terrible, terrible shot. So I went in and found reverse shots of the band performing and the Pips dancing, and I cheated those in. And because they're reverse shots, you can't see any lips moving, so, you know.
Do you remember opening montage over Stevie playing the drums?
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about that montage and how that was constructed, why it was done.
The film opens fairly abstractly. You're dropped into this crowd. There's tape glitches. You hear announcements. And suddenly Stevie Wonder's performing. And it is amazing to just watch him perform, but we just felt like we need to drop a little information in here to help the audience begin to understand what's going on. And we're kind of announcing our themes up there as well. Theme of change for Black culture, Black fashion, Black music. So we just wanted to drop those little nuggets into this montage. And also it lent itself nicely to a montage.
Was that the Harlem montage or was that later?
The Harlem montage is a little bit later.
Ah, yeah. Got it.
So first we set up the sort of theme in the film, the broad strokes theme. And then when we land in Harlem, it's kind of like, how can you not do a Harlem montage? We got to do a little Harlem flavor, give props to Harlem.
Yeah, love it. There's a nice graphic treatment on the first interviewee. Did you just stick a placeholder in there? How did that evolve? Do you remember?
Oh, that's a very interesting little story. So on some of the stills, we decided to put a big white border around the figure itself because we found a photograph of Charlene Hunter Gault, who is the great New York Times journalist and who then went on to be in NewsHour and is in the film. We found an archival photo of her in 69 when she was working at the Times. And it had this bizarre white, big fat white border around her figure. But then you could see the rest of the background. She's sitting in a newsroom and there's other people. And somebody told us that that's how they would cut people out if they wanted to put their image on something else.
Hmm.
They would literally paint a big white border around it and then re-photograph it, which is really strange. And we just liked how that looked. So we're trying to be true to the times.
Talk to me a little bit about the choice of the order of the music, because it seemed to tell a story. I'm assuming, as you kind of pointed out, we only took one song out of six or seven that a band would play, but the songs were chosen in an order.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we wanted to have the arc of this movie be the change that occurred in 69. 1969 was this really intense pivot point for Black culture, Black music, and Black fashion. And it was all represented at this festival. And so, yes, absolutely. The music starts out. We decided to have the music start out as a bit of a grab bag. You go from Stevie on the drums to the Chambers Brothers doing very modern, very late 60s funk, to B.B. King doing the old traditional blues. And that actually almost represented how the first concert actually was. So the six weekends were actually broken up by theme. There was a gospel weekend, there was a jazz weekend, there was a Motown weekend. We didn't want to hew to the actual real timeline of the film. We wanted to have some flexibility. And so in the film, we kind of represent that and it goes to the fifth dimension. Then there's that great natural segue to the Edwin Hawkins Singers, that huge gospel group, all dressed in lime green. That actually happened on day one. They wanted to do a kind of grab bag, broad spectrum of the music. And so that's what we did. But once we hit gospel, it was sort of like the classic, let's go from the old stuff to the new stuff. We're going to start with the roots, which is gospel and B.B. King blues. And then that ends up with the Staples Singer. It starts off with the Staples Singers, who have that really primal sound that really just sounds old and new all at once. I mean, they were just amazing. And then we go up all the way from gospel to Motown. We're progressing through time. And then we get to Sly and the Family Stone, which represents the future of Black music, with a little detour into Latin music, because, oh, by the way, Harlem is not just about African-American population. There's a huge Latin population there, too. And the music was influencing Black music. Black music was influencing Latin music. And then from there, we jet off into the activist final third of the film, which is represented by Nina Simone, of course, who was doing not the old jazz standards that she used to do, but doing her original compositions. She only started doing original compositions in the late 60s. Hmm. Before that, she was pretty much just doing standards and covers. So we definitely wanted to draw that line through the history of music. There's actually a great moment where Tony Lawrence, the MC, he has a great line at the end of the gospel section where he says, "All right, well, we got a lot more for you here, folks. I mean, what you just saw was only the first 15 minutes of Black music." And it was perfect. It was exactly what we needed him to say.
I love it. Talk to me about determining when to come in and out of performances into the more documentary elements, like the footage of the Harlem art scene during the Chambers Brothers Harlem song.
Yeah. It's always a tough thing. As you know, you've edited music films. I've edited concert films and music films. And it's always very hard to break away from the song. And you've always got the audience. When you're thinking about your audience, what do they want? You got a broad range of opinions. Some people wish that we'd let the songs play longer. But other people love the documentary content. So it's a tricky, delicate balance for this particular film. I did stumble upon this kind of funny rule of thumb where I felt like, all right, if I'm at a concert with some friends and one of my favorite bands comes on, at a certain point, I'm going to lean over and say something to my friend about the band. Like, oh my God, aren't these guys amazing? I saw them last year. So I kind of used that. I was like, at what point are we going to lean over and start whispering in the audience's ear?
I love that. That the greatest rule of thumb, because it's totally true. You know, at one point you go, check out the elephant flare pants, right?
Exactly. Oh my God, look at the drummer. Yeah.
That's a great answer.
But there's also more musical reasons, of course. There's an intro, then there's going to be a couple bars of verse, and then a couple bars of the chorus, and then it goes back to a couple bars of verse, maybe one more chorus. Maybe not. Yeah. It depends on the song. If a song has a lot of sections, like the Gladys Knight and the Pips song, it seemed to have a lot of sections that I wanted to represent. There's a lot of complex editing in there because it was a long version of that song, like 5.5 minutes, and we crunched it down to 1.5 or 2.
Yeah, and you've always got to be cognizant of the form of the song. You can't go, oh, well, I can't go from the chorus to the verse if there's a bridge in there, and we got to have the bridge.
Yeah, exactly. And then other songs, though, like Sly and the Family Stone, the first song that we use, there's like 3 distinct sections that they just repeat over and over again, like 3 or 4 times. So on that, I felt like I had license to, like, we're done with these 3 sections in the first 45 seconds. Now it's time to lean over to the audience and start talking to them. So yeah, that's how I figured that out. Some tracks were really just used as score. Like, there's a great little scene about how fashion was changing. It's a very dialogue heavy scene because it's all talk about fashion. I just chose to use a jazz track because there's no lyrics that are going to get in the way. And it also conveniently was Mongo Santa Maria's version of the Herbie Hancock song, Watermelon Man. So there's very little of that song in there. It's a great song, but unless you're a huge jazz fan, it gets a little repetitive after a while. So it seemed to be the perfect song to put a big chunk of dialogue on. And then let the end play out, and that's when Lynn Miranda comes in and says, you know, that was Herbie Hancock's Watermelon Man.
Talk to me about when to show interviewees on camera. I worked for Oprah for a while, and we had very strict rules about talking heads.
Oh, interesting. That's funny. The job I went to after finishing the film was for Oprah. I worked on The Me You Can't See, that mental health show that she did with Prince Harry, known as Prince. Yes, I've done a bunch of stuff for OWN, but there was no hard and fast rule. It's more just a feel. We didn't want to show people, so you just kind of try to establish them at some point, and then they can be off camera for a while, unless they're making incredible facial expressions.
Right, or, you know, emotional things. I remember
totally
one of the few places that I can remember on, and I can't remember who the woman was. She was with another guy, though. I thought it was
Oh, that's the incredible interview we got with Marilyn McCoo and Billy Davis Jr. from The Fifth Dimension.
Right, so you're on them occasionally for...
Yeah, because they were just adorable. How could they not be on camera? I mean, they were just such a joy. Just looking at them brings you joy. So keep them on camera.
Yeah, exactly.
Because that was just a perfect storm of the right elements. I mean, they're watching themselves perform. Their performance is amazing. But again, it gets a little repetitive. So let's cut away to them. And then they get revealed and they're just so beautiful now. They're just as beautiful as they were back then.
Yeah.
You know, they're a married couple. And they actually got married that year in 1969. So they've been married since 69.
Wow.
And they still perform. They've been out there as Marilyn McCoo and Billy Davis Jr. for a long, long time.
And they were emotional about seeing themselves.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, they are kind of an odd group in that they are very pop. They're very pop. And they have a very clean, shiny, poppy sound for a lot of their stuff. Some less so.
They were kind of saying, we're a white band.
Yeah, well, they were saying that they had been accused of being too white, that they weren't being black enough. That was something that bothered them for their whole career. So it was just wonderful to have them tell that story. I love the soundbite she gave us, which was, how do you color a sound?
Mm-hmm. I remember that bite.
I almost thought that should be like the title of the film exactly. Or something.
Was there any discussion, and then I kind of, as I watched the film more, I realized that there's just no way of trying to get rid of some of those long video dissolves. I mean, back in the 60s, those guys loved the Vision Mixer. They're like, oh, let's do a dissolve that takes 4 seconds, you know?
Totally. Again, I mean, we had no choice because there were no ISOs. So I do a lot of work for Radical Media. And there's definitely kind of been a rule there for many, many years of no cross dissolves. They're too old fashioned. They're too 60s. They're too easy. So in the beginning of the film, various producers were like, we're going to be able to get rid of those cross dissolves, right? And I'd say like, yeah, don't worry about it. It's going to be fine. But in the end, we couldn't really. I mean, again, I cheated a lot of stuff. And of course, cheated in crowd shots all over the place to try to break up some of the cross-dissolviness. But no, there were a lot of instances where we had no choice. And it's up to personal taste. Some people like it, some people don't. I think somebody said to me, I love that part of Nina Simone where the guitar player's superimposed over her face. So cool. Did you do that? And I was like, nope. Yeah, I had no choice. That was a particularly egregious section of cross dissolving, that first Nina Simone song, Backlash Blues. I feel like the guy must have put the lever at 50% and walked away for a cigarette break or something. He really thought he was making art, but yeah, we couldn't do anything about him. We didn't have any ISOs.
That's so interesting.
So I like to say, we're bringing cross dissolves back. We're going to make America love cross dissolves again.
All right. I'm waiting for it. It doesn't sound like Radical Media is going to let you do that, but
we'll see. Maybe this might have changed things over there.
This might do it. In addition to all of the musical choices, there's some really great sound bites. And I was thinking when I heard the sound bite, black people don't know about psychiatrists and therapists, but we know Mahalia Jackson. Do you just put that in a special bin that says we have to use this quote?
Absolutely. Yeah. It was like, yep, there's the perfect segue to Mahalia Jackson. Al Sharpton was really, really an impressive soundbite machine. obviously, I mean, the guy has been a media figure for many, many years, and, you know, has got his own show on CNN. And so, yeah, he was just a machine. It was kind of tough to get him. He's very busy. And the day we interviewed him, he was running behind, of course, and he came in with an assistant, and he seemed a little tense. And he was like, all right, guys, I only have half an hour. Usually these interviews are like 90 minutes. Mm-hmm. And so the producer, Joseph, was like, oh, damn, oh, how are we going to do this? Only 30 minutes with Al Sharpton. But pretty much every sentence was a usable soundbite. It was kind of amazing. He was great.
So some documentaries avoid See and Say, and there were places where you kind of embraced it. When you were building this doc out, listening to sound bites, did you make a list of stuff that you wanted a researcher to find? Like, oh, we need this from Harlem, and we need this from the civil rights movement. And
absolutely, yeah. We knew we were going to hit all these beats. So it's a concert film, but wedged into it, we realized eventually that we wanted to cram in the big beats of Black cultural history and the history of the civil rights movement. Because again, 69 was a hugely transformative year where the nonviolent civil rights movement of Dr. Martin Luther King was kind of ending. He had been assassinated the year before. And in 69, the Black Panthers were really starting to take off. We knew we needed all of that stuff. And it's kind of funny because the last big late 60s doc I worked on was a four-part limited series doc for Netflix called Bobby Kennedy for President, which was fantastic. It was really a great, fun project to work on, directed by Dawn Porter. The working title for that film for a long time was 1968, because that film ends in 68. And there was so much crossover in terms of the archival footage, but because they're separate jobs separated by a couple of years, like from now on, we just got to save all this archival footage because we're going to use it again eventually. And I literally, to the point where I'd have to say to the archivist, who was a different archivist who had worked on the Bobby Kennedy show, oh, I remember there was a shot of Huey Newton getting punched out by a police officer. Can we find that again? And it was painful to have to re-find a lot of stuff, but we make a list. We give it to her.
Yeah, I'm working on a documentary right now that takes place in 1936, and a lot of it is the CCC and WPA.
Oh, wow.
And I contacted a friend over at Ken Burns Documentary Company. I'm like, you guys, I know you guys have to have a ton of WPA and CCC footage. Help me out. I need all that stuff.
Yeah, it is a nightmarish job. The poor archival researcher. It's not an easy job.
No, it's not. This might be heavily edited. I don't know. But one of the longest, to me, seemingly unedited sections was Mahalia singing MLK's favorite song after Jesse Jackson describes his assassination. Can you talk to me about the creative decisions about using an extended musical piece right there?
Yeah, there's sort of two major pivot points in the film. One is the Mahalia Jackson Mavis Staples song, because that is, of course, also the story of Martin Luther King's death, his assassination. And there's just something so insanely powerful about that whole song. It is unedited. Just the way that Mahalia Jackson builds herself up to this peak of almost heavy metal screaming at one point, and her mouth is open so wide you can count her fillings and her molars. It's crazy. It just blows your head off. And then there's a literal passing of the torch to Mavis Staples, where she hands Mavis the microphone. And then Mavis picks it up and continues the song. Actually, Mavis starts it. It goes to Mahalia, but then she passes the mic back to Mavis and they duet for a little bit. But it's a passing of the torch. And that's this transitional moment out of the old and into the new, out of the older civil rights movement represented by King into this new era represented by the Black Panthers and in the increasingly militant music. So it was just a big moment. And it's also an incredible performance. It's just an amazing performance. And then the other pivotal moment is the Apollo moon landing. So there you have this turn from the futuristic funk and Latin good time music of Sly and the Family Stone and Ray Barreto and Mongo Santa Maria then we're making a very conscious turn to the sort of more militant aspects of late 60s black music.
Did you worry at all about cutting between aspect ratios?
Not really, because we're not really seeing the interviews that much. We played around with blowing it up a little bit, but it goes back to having it be an artifact. We're not trying to disguise the fact that it's an artifact. It is immersive just by the nature of the power of the performances themselves. And it was shot very well, too. There's great tight shots and all that stuff. But we wanted to keep the weird edges sometimes. There's weird rainbow stuff happening on the edges.
Yeah, I noticed that.
We like that stuff. Yeah. I mean, I don't know if people know this. I don't see it in much of the press. But people say, oh, the film quality is so cool. And it's not film.
Right, no, it's videotape.
It's videotape. They shot it, and they shot it live, and it was live line cut onto 2-inch videotape reels, which was amazing. We had the original reels, and my producer found, I said, what's the name of that place out in Long Island? He said, I don't know. It's just two guys on Long Island. So these two guys on Long Island, I'm sure their name is in the credits, but they digitized it. It had been digitized before, because like I said, two different directors had tried to make this film in the last 10 or 15 years. They just didn't get it off the ground. So some of it had been digitized before, but we had it freshly digitized, which was great.
One of my favorite cuts that I noticed that I loved was Ruffin is singing My Girl, and he points up to some guy, and it cuts to a guy in a tree.
Yeah.
You had to have created that.
That's a cheat. I'm a cheater.
I love that. It looks like it's real. It's
I had to do it, because also that's the lyric at that moment. He sings just like a bird in any tree, and then he waves up high. And he says, how you doing, brother? And I think he actually was looking at a guy in a tree.
Yeah.
There was no reverse shot of the guy in the tree, but luckily there were two shots of two people in the tree, and I used both of them.
Yeah, that was a pretty brilliant cut. Was there film footage beyond the video footage? And I can't believe there wasn't. That's amazing.
No, that's the only thing. I mean, again, it speaks to the erasure of Black history and the fact that this incredible festival got zero news coverage that we know of. The only news coverage we found was that Apollo landing day, the day of the Apollo landing. Somebody working for Walter Cronkite said, oh, I have an idea. Let's send our guy into the middle of this concert I heard about in Harlem.
Let's send this uptight white dude down.
Yeah, exactly.
The reason why I thought that there was another video crew or someone that was out there was exactly the reason you talked about, like the weird edging.
Yeah.
In the Sly and the Family Stone section, it looked like every once in a while it would cut in the video. The edges of the video were a little different, slightly different width.
Yeah, I mean, I think some of it just degraded. But no, there's no film. It's just these 2-inch reels.
Interesting. A geeky question. The transition out of the end of Sly's Everyday People. There's a fade transition at the end of it.
I believe that that is this wonderful moment where one of the attendees that they found, this guy named Daryl Lewis, who is just incredible. And he's the guy, he's bald and he has this huge smile. He's the one who tells this hilarious story of waiting for Sly to get on the stage. He's the guy who tells the story of you don't know when they're going to appear.
Yeah.
You don't know if he's actually going to show up. He was amazing, that guy. He's just a regular guy, but he's very knowledgeable. He's a huge music fan, and he knows all about all the artists. Anyway, so he's the guy who, during David Ruffin, says, me and my friends, we were suit and tie guys. We knew all the moves. We were huge Motown fans. And then it comes back full circle at the end of Sly's set. He says, after we saw Sly and the Family Stone, we were no longer suit and tie guys. The change was in effect. And then it cuts to black. And then it goes from Sly into the Latin section. And then the Latin section ends with Ray Barreto doing that great little riff where he's like, there's a part of me in everyone. I've got Indian blood, black blood, white blood. I'm all mixed up, and we got to get it together down here on Earth instead of up on the moon. And then that cuts to black, and then it fades up on the archival footage of the Apollo landing.
What was the choice of the final music and the last interview? How did that feel correct for your theme or for the emotion that you were trying to achieve?
the last moment where we see Moussa Jackson. Yeah, the choice there was he just summed up everything we were trying to say with this film, which is the themes of Black erasure, of you don't know about these things that have occurred in Black history. Black people don't know about them. And for him to have seen this footage that he thought might have just been a false memory. He wasn't sure it really happened. Mm-hmm. He was very young at the time, and he just wasn't sure it had happened. And to actually see it again took him back to this place. He got so emotional, so he cries. And anyone crying is documentary gold, of course. So. But it just seemed like the perfect ending for the film and summed up everything. He's like, thank you, thank you. Now I know I'm not crazy. And also, it was just so beautiful. He says, mm-hmm. which sums it up, you know. Yeah. And the final music ends with Nina reading the poem by one of the last poets, very angry, militant, but also kind of hopeful and uplifting poem, very cutting edge and avant-garde. But we realized we couldn't just go out. And then it cuts to the scene that's sort of like the false ending where you see Nina perform, then it suddenly cuts to black, like the end of The Sopranos. Where you're like, well, what happened? Did the film break? And that is representing this disappeared. And then there's a montage of those beautiful still photographs of the empty park right after the concert, trash on the ground. But we realize we can't leave people with a downer. So to get people back up, Questlove very much wanted to end with Take You Higher.
Sly
and the Family Stone, yeah. Because it's an incredible performance where he gets everybody call and response and everyone's pumping their fists in the air. And it's just fantastic. Again, that represented the theme of the film. Questlove put it beautifully when he introduced a live screening of the film in Harlem at Mount Morris Park, which was mind blowing. That's a whole other story. But he said he wanted to make a film that was more about Black joy and less about Black pain. There's a lot of stuff that represents Black pain out there that obviously we all need to see and absorb. But, you know, he wanted to swing the other way a little bit. There's plenty of Black pain in the film, but in smaller amounts than you would think. And then he wanted to end it with joy.
One of the things that I loved seeing as an editor was how close to the beginning of the credits your name appeared.
That was nice. Yes.
It's that like nice. Questlove and then you. Like, not quite that much, but it was close.
Yeah. Well, the three of us, myself, Joseph Patel, and Questlove, were really the triumvirate who were working on this film during the pandemic. So we were lucky in that we shot about half or maybe two-thirds. There aren't that many interviews in the film. Maybe 15, maybe 12. We shot maybe half to two-thirds of them before the lockdown. And then I was able to work with that all summer long in my basement. Which actually was great, because I got to tell you, I love working at home. I'm happy to do it for the rest of my life on every single job, if possible.
I'll talk to your agent about that.
I am so much more productive. It's, as you probably know, a happy editor is a good editor, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing for me, because I do a lot of that myself, is... Yeah. That I have moments where I just know that I'm not inspired and I shouldn't be editing. And there's other times when I'm like, oh man, I know it's 7 o'clock at night, but I got a great idea. I go until 2 o'clock in the morning. Why not edit that way and not edit from 2 o'clock in the afternoon to six?
Absolutely. Totally. And then I'm also cutting out and like probably an hour and a quarter of, you know, more like 2 hours every day of commuting in and out of New York City. So it was great. I was able to stay in the zone for a lot longer. And yeah, work at odd hours. Go get some exercise in the middle of the day and work at night. And there's even times where I would lose sleep about a problem with the film that I was having. And if I can't sleep, ultimately, you know, I try to read for a while. Or I try to walk around. But then I was like, to hell with it. I'm going to go down and work. Mm-hmm. So I'd work from 2 to 4 in the morning.
Yeah. We talked a little bit about the order of the songs. How did you figure that out? Was that a lot of Questlove choosing music? Did you have a set list that you were pulling songs off the set list?
We had note cards before the lockdown. We had the standard colored note card thing going on and the push pins. And I've been trying to move to a digital version of that. So I was using Google stickies or whatever the hell they're called, super primitive colored note card thing.
Final Draft has something like that now.
Yeah. And then there's something else I started using on this other job that's exactly that, which is very easy to use. And so, yeah, totally. We would always have a board going with try and move things around and, oh, that didn't work. And let's try this first and then go to that. And so, yeah, we played with structure quite a lot. And Questlove was very, very into talking about structure and figuring out how it would flow best and what he wanted to really represent in terms of this arc of the music and the culture and all that stuff. So, yeah, we would play with the note cards a lot.
Love it. Thank you so much for your time tonight. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
It was great talking to a fellow editor, as usual.
Great. Thanks so much.
That's it for Art of the Cup this week. Thank you so much for listening. Again, these interviews are also available to read at blog.frame.io, where they're supported with great visual content, images, video clips, and more. It's an opportunity to check out the other expert content on the blog for filmmakers of all types. Also, check out my book, Art of the Cut, Conversations with Film and TV Editors for a Topic-Driven Curated Experience. Thanks to my guest, Joshua L. Pearson. Thanks to Jake Gum for editing today's podcast using Adobe Audition. And thanks to Frame.io for their support of Art of the Cut and its pledge to keep this content coming your way. If this is a podcast that you got something out of, follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Steve Hullfish. And so you don't miss out on all the great upcoming interviews on the Art of the Cut podcast, subscribe to this podcast. And remember that if you have a friend in the film business or who aspires to be in the film business, make sure to tell them about the Art of the Cut podcast and blog.frame.io.